This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We can't predict that in 6 months' time something won't come out of left field that looks entirely different.
That's South African epidemiologist Dr. Jill Barnes, who says it is much too early to hail the comparative mildness of the Omicron variant. Details coming up. Also today, at least 10 people were killed in a suicide car bombing in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Authorities in Burkina Faso say they have arrested 8 soldiers for allegedly plotting to destabilize the government. Henry Wilkins reports from the capital, Ouagadougou.
Burkina Faso's military prosecutor released a statement Tuesday afternoon stating that 8 soldiers have been arrested after planning to destabilize the institutions of the republic. The main suspect is reported to be Lieutenant Colonel Emmanuel Zungrana. Zungrana, along with other military leaders, was relieved of his post by President Roch Kabore in December after an attack on a military base in the north of the country, allegedly by terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda, killed at least 49 military personnel. The arrests took place Monday night, but authorities did not say where. Asked for a comment on how the plot was detected, a military spokesman said the prosecutor did not wish to speak to the media at this time. Meanwhile, access to the internet on cell phone networks has been disrupted since Monday afternoon. Late last year, the government shut down the internet for 8 days as protests against insecurity swept the country. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
Witnesses and officials say at least 10 people were killed and 9 wounded today in a suicide car bombing targeting government security convoy on a road leading to the airport in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The blast occurred near a checkpoint leading to the heavily fortified airport perimeter. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility, saying they targeted a convoy escorting Somali government and foreign officials. Mogadishu's deputy mayor, Ali Yari Ali, said he survived the attack without giving more details. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu condemned the attack. It came just days after Somali leaders agreed on a new timetable for long-delayed elections and a feud between Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble and President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. French-Malian relations have become strained as Mali's military junta consolidates power and Paris ends its counter-terrorism mission in the troubled Sahel country. French President Emmanuel Macron says France will not work with Mali unless it transitions to democracy. France plans to reduce Operation Barkhane from 5,000 to 2,500 troops by early 2022. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi discussed with Emily Estelle, research manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, how could that threaten counterterrorism gains in the Sahel?
The coup in Mali threatens counterterrorism gains by making it more difficult for the French and for the other European forces that are supposed to backfill the French to actually work with Malian troops and with the Malian government, which is still being ruled by the junta. So one challenge is deploying the forces that are meant to backfill the French at the bases they're withdrawing from, such as in Timbuktu. Another challenge is the Malian government's strained relationships with its neighbors, which will also complicate deployments and joint operations, particularly because of the border closures that we saw come through this week.
Malian officials have described this initial drawdown as abandoned, suggesting that France may leave vast territories unprotected and that Mali needs a plan B, a reference to the proposed deal with Russian private military company Wagner Group. The reported Wagner Group deal does not include counter-terrorism support. How could such a deal impact the Western efforts to combat terrorism in the region?
The Wagner deal and now the presence of Wagner forces in Mali introduces several complications. So one is that the European task force and the French forces are not going to be inclined to work with Malian units that are already being trained by Wagner. Another factor is the effect that Wagner forces will have directly on the situation. So if Wagner forces engage in human rights abuses or profiting off of the mining economy, which is something we've seen them do or at least try to do in other African countries, then the Wagner presence is going to worsen the grievances that are already benefiting jihadist groups in Mali.
A recent survey showed that Malian people prefer Wagner group over French presence. How would you explain that?
Sure. So there are a couple factors at play. One is that there has been a longer running backlash to the French counterterrorism mission, in part because of the tensions in the French-Malian colonial relationship that go way back. But then more recently, because of the impression that the French operation has lasted too long and that it hasn't had its desired effects. And there is some truth to the kind of shortcomings in the counterterrorism mission. But the other piece is more recent and political. So the French government has pushed back hard on the Malian junta. So with the coup, has pushed the Malian military leadership to transition back to democracy. And so those leaders in Mali have an incentive to find other partners. And Wagner Group, in this case, is not going to exert that kind of pressure. And certainly the Russian government generally will not. So it strengthens the junta in its relationships with other countries to have that agreement with Wagner Group.
So what are the scenarios for Salafi jihadi groups to capitalize on this reduced pressure, consolidate their positions, and possibly surge attacks to expand their influence in the Sahel region?
So I expect to see Salafi jihadi groups consolidate their positions in northern and central Mali with a focus on embedding themselves into local government structures. So an intensification of the trend that has already been going on. And they will conduct attacks probably focused on deterring security forces and making it hard for the military to operate in the countryside. This means that military influence and the influence of the Malian state generally will be even more limited in these parts of the country and be concentrated around key economic assets like mines. So I also expect to see Salafi jihadi groups, particularly JNIM, which is Al-Qaeda's branch in Mali, to use negotiations to strengthen their position and encourage the withdrawal of foreign forces. So this is something that JNIM has already talked about and already started to push for. It's explicitly mimicking what the Taliban achieved in Afghanistan. And so that model is going to replicate itself throughout kind of different groups within the larger Al-Qaeda network, including in Mali.
That was Emily Estelle, Research Manager of the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. A top South African epidemiologist says it is much too early to hail the comparative mildness of the Omicron variant as the beginning of the end of COVID-19. Dr. Joe Barnes of Stellenbosch University has been monitoring Omicron's behavior since it was first detected in the country 3 months ago. Since then, scientific studies have suggested that while Omicron's highly infectious, it causes less serious illness and far fewer hospitalizations and deaths than previous variants. As Darren Taylor reports, this has sparked speculation that the pandemic is losing its potency.
Barnes says she's surprised that medical scientists around the world are saying that variants will get ever milder as time goes on, and that COVID-19 will eventually devolve into something akin to a common cold.
There are several gaps in that reasoning. The first one is that Omicron didn't evolved directly from Delta, and Delta didn't evolve from Beta. In fact, Omicron is so much different that laughingly some people call it a deviant and not a variant. So we can't predict that in 6 months' time something won't come out of left field that looks entirely different.
Barnes cautions against raising hope too soon. She says it's also too quick to say COVID-19 will become endemic and predictable, like seasonal flu.
The politicians seem to think that endemic means that it is now going to turn into something that will help us become business as usual, and we can just live with this thing. I'm worried that if it doesn't materialize, we're going to cause a huge number of people to become even more discontented and lose faith in the authorities. That way we will lose the battle against the virus.
The epidemiologist says her greatest fear is that unscientific speculation will spark complacency.
If you look at previous pandemics and previous viruses, they did not all progress towards milder and milder versions of the virus. Ebola is becoming more and more deadly as it goes on. So we can't promise people that. It is too early, and I think, to be honest, it's partly driven by sentiment, by hope, and perhaps also partly by politics.
Barnes is concerned that more potentially devastating variants could emerge in unvaccinated populations in Africa. The World Health Organization says less than 10% of Africans are fully vaccinated. Barnes blames this on so-called vaccine hoarding by wealthy countries and on pharmaceutical companies refusing to share vaccine recipes, which would allow billions more jabs to be produced. She says the pandemic's now politicized.
And right behind politics, we have money. Those two things are shattering the world, and we are shooting ourselves in the foot every day, because we will have to work together across ideologies, across different nations, if we are going to beat this thing. And right now, my hopes are low.
Barnes says poor examples from global figures are also cause for concern. From British Prime Minister Boris Johnson allegedly attending parties during his nation's lockdown, to tennis star Novak Djokovic refusing to be vaccinated.
We already have seen right across the world, not only here, governments handling the outbreak of the pandemic not very well in places and at certain times. And so we are ending up with a great resistance to the only real weapon we have, and that is vaccination.
This resistance, she says, can be seen in the continued rise of the anti-vax movement, which seems to her to be getting stronger as the pandemic continues.
Denial is a great part of that. We are seeing this now on a global scale. It seems as if world politics is in such a weak state that they can't rein those mavericks in.
The scientist says now, at a pivotal point in the pandemic, a dangerous mix of misinformation, false hope, selfishness, denialism, and plain stupidity threatens to prolong the world's pain. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Authorities in Cameroon say at least 25,000 villagers in the northeast who fled communal fighting in neighboring Chad last month have returned. But hundreds were left homeless by the fighting between ranchers and fishermen, and more than 75,000 are reluctant to go home. Mokirwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon's Ministry of Territorial Administration says at least 25,000 civilians who fled intercommunal violence along its northern border to Chad have returned home. A statement read on Cameroon State Radio CRTV on Monday said the civilians are returning because the area is once again peaceful. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Midjiyawa Bakari, says a December peace mission to convince armed men to drop their weapons was a success. He spoke to VOA via messaging application from Maroua, the capital of the far north region.
Il y a trois semaines, nous avons eu à descendre pour régler un problème, un conflit ethnique.
Bakari says thousands of civilians who fled to Chad because of the intercommunal violence between Arab Shua and ethnic Musgum have been returning to Cameroon each week since December 16. He says the returnees are responding to Cameroon President Paul Biya's appeal for them to return home, seek peace, and develop their communities. But Bakari said several hundred returnees were left homeless because their houses were torched in the conflict. Authorities say clashes between ranchers and fishers over water and land erupted along the border on December 7, leaving at least 10 people dead and scores wounded. The UN says the violence between the two communities pushed at least 102,000 civilians to flee to neighboring Chad. Among the civilians who escaped to Chad is 41-year-old mother of two, Anne Jigwe. She told CRTV she returned from the Chadian capital N'Djamena on January 2 when envoys sent by Cameroon's government convinced her it was safe. Jigwe says fighting between Arab Shua ranchers and ethnic Musgum fishers has brought agony to both communities. She says a few returnees are privileged to live in tent houses while a majority sleep in the open air. She says all of them need houses, water and food. Cameroonian authorities say many of those left homeless were able to stay with relatives or in village mosques or churches. Mununa Futsu is Minister of Youth Affairs and Civic Education in Mayodanai on Cameroon's border with Chad. He says some of the returnees are seeking help.
Je me sens dans l'obligation de nous interpeller tous.
Futsu says as community leader in Mayodanai, he has an obligation to plead with citizens living in Cameroon's northern border to help their brothers and sisters returning from Chad. He says people who are not affected by the clashes should share their lodging, food and water with returning civilians whose houses or farms were torched during the conflict. Cameroonian authorities say they have rebuilt three markets that were torched in the conflict and are supplying food, seats and mattresses to resettle people affected by the clashes. But community leaders say over 75,000 of the villagers who fled to Chad are still reluctant to return. The Cameroon Civil Society Organization says it will be difficult to convince many of those who fled to return without the government reconstructing homes and plantations that were destroyed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe's immigration crisis is creating a domino effect with its neighbors, specifically South Africa, bearing the brunt as women cross the border to give birth. Arigando gives us more on the story.
In a video circulating on social media, South African Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi says over 70% of the women seeking maternity services at the hospital in Musina are impoverished Zimbabweans. Analysts say the situation exposes Zimbabwe's structural problems, specifically a healthcare system on the verge of collapse. The South African Home Affairs Minister has been a target of criticism from the ruling party members of ZANU-PF in South Africa for his government's ongoing blitz against illegal immigrants. The minister says the current crackdown targets border jumpers rather than genuine permit holders. Motsoaledi has also alleged that Zimbabwean security officers are taking bribes to help border jumpers. Zimbabwe has denied the claim. State media reports in Zimbabwe reported that since the operation started, 89,000 people have been arrested trying to illegally cross the border. 10 people reportedly drowned while trying to cross the Limpopo River a few days ago. Observers say the situation lays bare the deep structural problems in Zimbabwe's public services and the cascading impact on its neighbors despite the government's denial of a crisis. Mabuto Mabena of the Zimbabwe South Africa Association in South Africa says Harare needs to accept and address the long-standing crisis.
It is not the first time that we've been told that women from Zimbabwe flood Musina Hospital and the Wanmu Hospital in Ehurulen. I'm not sure whether it's Tembisa Hospital, but they always mention a hospital in Ehurulen where they come and give birth. This calls on the Zimbabwean government to be serious in terms of rebuilding the economy.
A number of hospitals in South Africa told VOA they are charging up to over $300 if people do not have permits. Those who can't afford it are being turned away. The numbers of undocumented Zimbabweans far outnumber the less than 178,000 ZTP permit holders. Mabena says the crisis at the Bay Bridge border post is linked to the economic crisis.
When a country has close to 90% people in the informal sector, it's natural that they will go out of the country. to look for products to resell in the country.
Mabena maintains the government is trying to find this out by blaming its wars on international sanctions.
It's clear that this crisis is not as a result of the economic sanctions as argued by the Zimbabwean government and ZANU-PF. It's a crisis that has been created by the looting class in Zimbabwe. They continue to loot the resources. They have no plan on how to rebuild the economy.
Analysts say the number of illegal border crossings reflects the exorbitant passport prices that Zimbabweans can't afford. Mbuso Fuzwayo, a socio-political analyst, concurs that neighboring countries are feeling the burden.
The government of Zimbabwe is not helping. It has created an immigration crisis within the region. So, and the SADC member states must be very open with Zimbabwe that it has created a crisis in the region, because this is now turning out to be a regional crisis. And the Zimbabwean government must take the blame and should not point fingers to anyone.
Mbuso Fuzwayo, a socio-political analyst, concurs that neighboring countries are feeling the burden.
Our health system has collapsed to the extent that if you are to look at women, pregnant women, going outside the country to go and deliver in foreign countries, it will tell you that the country is gone. There is no longer a country. There is no longer a government.
Fuzwayo and others blame economic mismanagement and mediocrity in governance, given the country's rich natural resources. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
As cases of gender-based violence have increased in Tanzania during the pandemic, some women are learning ways to fight back, including using their fists. Charles Kombe in Dar es Salaam explains.
Leila Yusuf is learning how to box. She trains every evening at a camp and says the sport helps keep her safe from gender-based violence. She says if she encounters a problem or any kind of gender-based violence, boxing helps a lot for self-defense. Not only for me, she said, but in defending others too. Data from Tanzania's Statistic Bureau shows that 40% of Tanzanian women and girls between 15 and 49 have experienced physical violence in their lifetime. 17% have experienced sexual violence. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, reports of violence against women and girls have increased. Joyce Makete is a social welfare officer. Makete says when COVID-19 arrived, there were many cases of gender-based violence, but there was no good way of documenting the statistics. Despite gender-based violence cases have increased during the pandemic, she said there were other general cases of violence. During this period when COVID-19 has slowed down in Tanzania, Makete added, cases of violence are still being reported but have not been categorized as being caused by COVID-19. For the women who have taken up boxing for self-defense, some are loving the sport, says boxing coach Kwame Hamis. Hamis said there are those who came only to learn how to defend themselves so they can face any challenge, including on the street. But they reach a point as they continue practicing, he says, that they love it and say they want to make boxing their career. Leila Yusuf is among those looking to become a professional boxer, although she doesn't have any fights scheduled. In the meantime, she continues to train every day and is encouraging other women to learn to box as a way to defend themselves. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA. VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.